inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
Publishers and agents and editors need to do is realize that stories told from these perspectives are fresh, they're new, we don't hear them a lot. So why aren't we willing to put them out there? In my workplace, I'm seeing a lot of emails going around about positive change in publishing. And one thing that a lot of people have said is that this time the change feels different. It doesn't feel like a trend this time.
Derek Owusu is a writer, poet, and author of That Reminds Me, the debut novel in verse that he started writing while he was in a mental health facility in 2019. It's the first novel to be published by Stormzy's imprint Murky Books, and on the 2nd of July it was awarded the 2020 Desmond Elliott Prize for New Fiction. The book centers around the character Kay, who Derek created to help himself explore how his early life in foster care could lead to borderline personality disorder. When Derek's diagnosis of BPD finally came, it was a relief, and he hopes the book will raise awareness for lesser-known mental health conditions and encourage parents to inquire more deeply into the troubled behavior in their children. He discovered a love for literature while studying exercise science at university when he was 23. Unable to afford a change of degree, he began reading voraciously and sneaking into English literature lectures whenever he could. His essay on Black men and insecurities was the second most read article on Media Diversified in 2018. And his essay on language was picked up by BBC Newsnight to be turned into a short documentary. He also collated, edited, and contributed to Safe, on Black British men reclaiming space, a timely anthology exploring the conflicts and complexities of being a Black man today. I'm Rachel Taylor, creative at AKQA, and your host for this episode of AKQA Insight. As a Black American, it feels like a very significant time for work by Black people to be recognized and celebrated to me personally. In your book, Derek, you raise so many timely issues: what it's like being Black in a primarily white space, how that affects creative output, the importance of raising up young Black people, and mental health. As people of all races work to understand these issues and become allies, I'm really looking forward to hearing your point of view on these things as someone who's been writing and speaking about them for years. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to AKQA Insight. Derek, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you start your book with an author's note, and I quote, "This is the story of Kay. If you believe your life to be as fictitious as Kay's, if you find yourself within the pages of this book, then you are holding the pen and not me." What did you mean by that? It was such a sort of a welcoming note, and I'd love to hear about that.
I meant a few things. The first thing was that I wanted to distance myself from the character of Kay because it's semi-autobiographical, I guess, in a way. About 20% of it is taken from my actual life. I wanted to make sure that people didn't read too much into it and think that this was like a memoir and I was literally just writing down my personal experiences. But also it was about giving people the space to connect with the book as well. Maybe connect with Kay, or if they have similar experiences to Kay. One thing that I'm very conscious of when I'm writing is that I don't want to dictate to the reader how to experience a book or a piece of writing or how it should be read or what certain things mean. I think one of the worst things an author can do is have a conversation with a reader and say, no, that's not what I meant. You're wrong. And I wanted to make sure that I was not doing that in any way.
Absolutely. Well, I, personally, from reading the book, I felt that there was so much space to really interpret and internalize it. And as you say, there were some similarities with your own life. So you were born to Ghanaian parents, as was Kay, but shortly afterwards, your father left the family and your mother had to give you up for foster care. So you spent the first part of your childhood with middle-class white foster parents in a Suffolk village. What has been your experience of being Black in predominantly white spaces? I think it's a question that's sort of on lots of our minds these days.
Yeah, so in terms of when I was personally in foster care, I can't really remember ever being conscious of the fact that I was Black and my foster mother was white.
Yeah.
I remember the moment that I did realize that I was different, and that was, I believe I was watching the A-Team, and I saw B.A. Baracus, Mr. T, his hair, and he had the mohawk. Mm-hmm. And I kept asking my foster mom, can you cut my hair like that? And then I remember going to school and talking to my friends about his hair, and then looking at their hair and thinking, they can't do that with their hair. that was the moment that I realized, okay, I'm different in some way. Where it wasn't like a real consciousness of being Black.
Mm. And what about today? I mean, you know, apart from the differences in ability to have a mohawk, which I absolutely hear, you know, in the creative world now, the literary world historically would be, you know, classified probably as predominantly white. Yeah. So how do you navigate this in the creative world today?
Yeah, it's difficult because of what's been going on. You become hyper aware of the fact that you're a Black person in a white space. So it's almost like you're watching yourself and you're watching your every move and everything you say, you're careful and things like that. And then you start to scrutinize what other people are saying. You almost become paranoid in a sense as well. Kind of like, what did they mean by that? What do they mean by this? Because they're probably aware of the fact that you're Black as well. So they're going to change their behavior. But then also on the flip side of that is that if they don't recognize the fact that you're Black, then they're more likely to say something ignorant, because it can sometimes come across as, I don't really care if you're Black. But it's not that they should care, but they should just be aware, because that's part of your identity. That's part of my identity. You know, it's part of my culture. Our cultures are not exactly the same. They're different. Me being a Black British Ghanaian, West African, my culture is going to be very different. So the hyper-awareness makes interactions sometimes very awkward, very stiff. In workplaces, I've heard a lot of stories about people, I guess they're white co-workers, asking them questions about Stormzy or things like this. And sometimes they're just kind of like, well, I don't listen to Stormzy, so I'm not really sure why you're asking me about him. Do you know what I mean?
I hear you. I think in your book, it was exactly as you say, that awareness of other cultures is what I think so much of the discussion today is about, as lots of conversations about anti-racism are happening. And, you know, as you say, you give the reader space in your book to sort of interpret this in the context of their own life. You and I have spoken before, and I told you, you know, my father's Jamaican, my mother is a white woman from Wisconsin. So I definitely had a bit of that experience in growing up with two cultures coming together, as did you. And that's another one of the questions I have. Your mother collected you and brought you to live with your aunt in London when you were seven. And you talk about that as a bit of a traumatic time. You were lonely, and it was a culture shock into Ghanaian life. Looking back, having lived in those two spaces, do you feel that it gave you a unique point of view, having lived with both Black and white families with vastly different cultures? And was there anything, you know, that you learned from those experiences or that you think back upon?
I wouldn't say it's given me a unique point of view. I think it has allowed me to embrace a lot more from both cultures, I would say.
Yeah.
And obviously, so that adds to my, I guess I can benefit from a lot more things. But one thing it has done to me is that, unfortunately, it's made me quite suspicious of white families fostering Black children or adopting Black children, because I never got to ask my foster mom why she fostered me, you know. Of course, because it was private foster care, my mom was paying her. But then when I went back to my mom, when I was about, I believe, 15, my mom gave me a bank account that my foster mom had set up. And all the money my mum was paying her, she was just putting this into a fund for me for when I was older. So it wasn't about the money. So that's made me very confused and just wanting to know why, because there was about 10 of us in the foster house and we were all Black West African. So yeah, it's made me, very, maybe suspicious isn't the right word, But I do question their motives, I guess.
I felt your curiosity. It was like, you know, you were a child who was having the same curiosity toward a parent figure that anyone would toward their parent figures. And it was a beautiful note that you had in that book, wishing you had a bit more time with your foster mother, who very sadly passed away from cancer. And I can imagine that it would be the same questions that anyone would have of someone sort of raising them early in life. One thing that is obviously quite present in your book and perhaps sort of related to that about questioning and sort of thinking how your life fits in with the ones who raised you and how those experiences came to shape you. You speak very openly about the mental health challenges that you faced throughout your life and your subsequent diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. Mm. And I'm curious about your experience of mental health in the Black community and the unique challenges Black people face when it comes to mental health. I can only speak on my own experience of that being quite a hard conversation to bring up in some cultures. And I wonder what your experience has been.
I remember always saying to my mom, I feel odd or I feel strange or,
yeah,
you know, there was always this kind of suicidal ideation that I've had since I was about 11. So it wasn't really, I guess I never really had the conversation with my mom. I guess it was just kind of, she had to experience what I was going through.
Yeah.
Not something I wish she had experienced, but I guess seeing the self-harm scars on my body and the first time that I attempted suicide, my mom was present. She was there. She was there when, you know, the ambulance came and things like that.
Yeah.
I think luckily for me, because I understand that my mom thinks in another language, so she doesn't think in English. So therefore, words like borderline personality disorder, depression, these kind of things, there's no word for them in Tree, which is one of the languages they speak in Ghana, the language my mom speaks. There's no word for it. So it's hard for her to conceptualize what it is I'm talking about. Luckily, what the NHS did, they sent over a Ghanaian doctor to my house to speak to my mom in Cree and try and explain exactly what it was I was going through. And after that happened, there was a massive shift. You know, my mom changed. She was a lot more understanding and a lot more helpful. She wasn't judgmental anymore. She even said to me that in Cree, so the word that mostly describes people who are going through, I guess, like a mental issue, it basically translates as mad. That person is mad. But after my mum seen what I've gone through, she said she's completely dropping that word from her vocabulary because she just finds it derogatory and she doesn't want to use it for people anymore. So she really started to understand things.
That's pretty amazing, both on the terms of in the sense of the NHS sending that doctor and in your mother and having such a receptive response to that. I wonder, it helps me think through, you know, throughout your book, you have such a beautiful context to the stories that are told. It's like sort of folklore and mythology is a bit woven in. There's lots of different words spoken to Anansi just directly. When you were writing your book, was there, did you have some thoughts about sort of contextualizing this for any particular audience or making it so that, you know, perhaps someone Ghanaian reading could understand in the same different and unique ways as someone British, for example?
No, I didn't. And I think because over the past couple of years, I've watched so many interviews with Toni Morrison and her talking about not explaining things to white readers, having the white gaze on her writing. I was just kind of like, I'm not going to explain anything. I feel like people can find out things if they want to.
Yeah.
You know, you can look up words or look up who Anansi is, you know. So, for example, you know, Neil Gaiman's American Gods, he has Mr. Anansi in there, which is obviously the personification of Anansi the spider. Guaranteed people went and Googled who was Anansi.
Yeah.
They would do that. You know, when I read Juno Diaz's books, there's a lot of, there's loads of words in there that I had to Google. Sometimes I have to sit there with my laptop, just going in and out. And I know sometimes it can be it can disrupt the narrative, but for authenticity's sake, you can't really be explaining every little detail. The one gaze that I was conscious of was the Ghanaian gaze, because I thought, I need to make sure I get this right, otherwise they're going to cost me.
Yeah, I can imagine. It goes back to this first thing that you said, which is everyone sort of being able to interpret this book in their own life. Anansi is extremely present in lots of Jamaican stories, so I knew it in that context, but it'll be a completely different interpretation that someone from a different culture or a different familiarity with Anansi or storytelling will have. And I thought that was sort of a kindness that you gave your readers in being able to sort of interpret it as they like. So, Derek, related to sort of your answer to that past question, I'm interested to know what types of conversations you're having with those around you in the midst of the anti-racism movement. I know that, you know, lots of these conversations are going on. So what are you talking about and who are you talking to?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of my friends, I can tell that they're fatigued by what's going on and the conversations that we've had in the past. Because it really does wear on you. When I was in university, I was really into Pan-Africanism and I was going to a lot of meetings, but it just got to the point where you just become exhausted and it's almost like you just need to check out from the world for a while and recharge and then come back into it. But with what's going on at the moment, it feels like there is no checkout.
Yeah.
There is no way to check out. It's all on social media. It's all on the news. You know, you go to work and then your workplace are talking about initiatives. How can we support Black people better? And it's just relentless, you know. But I mean, there are some good conversations happening. You know, in my workplace, I'm seeing a lot of emails going around about positive change in publishing and how they can help, how they can do better. So it's good to see. One thing that a lot of people have said is that this time, the change feels different. It doesn't feel like a trend this time. It feels like there may actually be some significant change in the way we treat and see and perceive Black people.
I think that's absolutely the hope. And I'm experiencing the same thing. And I think so many of us are. It's, you know, we all know that it's not the responsibility of Black people to educate everyone else or to make the change ourselves, that it's a collective responsibility. But it's this complication because now there's a platform and it feels like, at least from the outset, the world wants to hear what we have to say. So personally, I'm feeling under pressure to speak up and be louder than ever right now. Is that a pressure that you're feeling as well?
No, I don't feel like it's pressure.
Yeah.
I do feel like I have a moral obligation to do that. Like, I don't feel like anybody's putting pressure on me to do it. I just feel like I need to do it because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So a lot of what I've been doing is just donating to charities or GoFundMes, just loads of things just popping up because I feel like other people have a more powerful voice than I do or can articulate themselves better than I can, have a better grasp on what's going on and what needs to change. I have no idea how to change the world, but sometimes I see ideas thrown out and I'm like, that's a great idea. I would never have thought of that. Therefore, I'm glad to be, I guess, kind of in the shadows and let other people lead the way.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, you were speaking about your friends feeling fatigued. That's something that my friends have been feeling as well. Do you have any thoughts about how people can keep their mental health in mind during a time like this? I think it can be so draining. Have you had any conversations around that or do you have any sort of personal thoughts about it?
Yeah. So what one of my friends did was just, he just turned off his phone, no TV, no laptop for 48 hours. And he was just at home. I think he was just reading or he was writing, going for walks, sitting in parks with friends and stuff like that. Almost just like an off switch. And he said that he felt so much better. Also, I think one thing that's key is just delete all social media from your phone because you're just you're so tempted to go online on Twitter and conversations on Twitter are so convoluted and confused. It lacks nuance a lot of the time. And that can get you down as well because it may make you feel like things are not changing or they're halting because no one is talking about maybe Black Lives Matter anymore. But in the background, like not on social media, people are still doing the work. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Just kind of try and check out for at least 24 hours, 48 hours and just relax. Just do something you love doing, cook, watch some Netflix or something like that.
Well, so for many of us listening, I think that one of the things that we love, regardless of if we feel an increased moral obligation or pressure to do it right now, is creative output. So for the next part here, I'd love to talk to you about creativity, any insights you might have or be able to share from your own creative process and sort of the discussions you're having with others in this space right now.
You know, we know that communicators and storytellers have the opportunity to reform narratives. And we must continue to create topical and progressive work to collectively fight the negative and harmful stereotypes of Black people that are propagated by the media. I see it a ton coming from the United States. I'm sure it's incredibly present here as it is in other places. Do you have any advice for how businesses and brands can use their influence to make a difference here?
That's a good question.
I think it's the question on all of our minds. So,
yeah,
you know, we don't expect you to have the answer, but
yeah, I think what the best thing they can do at the moment actually is just put their money where their mouth is. The kind of gestures that we see online from brands, you know, putting up a statement of solidarity and all those kind of things, and in their workplace is a completely different story, or they're not using their clout or their finances to help level the playing field in their respective industries.
Yeah,
that's one thing that needs to happen, because you know we need capital in order to change a lot of things, in order to allow certain organizations to thrive and do what it is they need to do. That's one thing we need. We also need a lot of transparency from these companies as well.
Mm.
We need to know how many Black people have they hired? What's the pay discrepancy? All of these kind of things. We need to know them in order to change them. You know, I'm one of the founding members of the Black Writers Guild. You know, we sent a letter to, you know, the big five publishers and just asked them to do very, very standard things, you know, in order to help level the playing field when it comes to the publishing industry. Every publisher we sent the letter to, we heard from all of them. You know, we're in the process of setting up meetings so we can really talk through, you know, ways to get around this, so we could plot a path for the future, a path that's not going to take, you know, 5 years, you know, because what tends to happen is that a lot of companies say, okay, by, I don't know, 2024, we want to improve this, this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
But why does it have to be so slow?
Yeah, yeah.
There are faster ways to do it.
Well, in terms of representation and, you know, seeing people who look like us coming up in the industry, it reminds me of one of my favorite points in the book. And it's when Kay is remembering speaking to a love interest. And I'd love to read the passage. He writes, "After a late night library trip, I'd call her and say, 'Look at the moon. Black boys rarely speak on the poet's muse, so these twilight tropes seemed original. The moon is glowing new when seen through eyes deprived of cliche.'" And it just immediately it struck me that, you know, some voices like those of Black boys, which is brought up in this passage, just aren't heard very often. And what do you think we can do to change that?
I think we need to provide information. A lot of young Black boys, Black men who write have no idea how to be published. They have no idea how to approach an agent. They don't know where to find an agent. We need to provide them with these resources, this information. We need to make it readily available. Even with jobs as well, jobs in the publishing industry, a lot of them don't know what kind of jobs there are, you know, because they've never looked into it. Or again, the information is just not there. But also I think what publishers and agents and editors need to do is realize that stories told from these perspectives are fresh. They're new. We don't hear them a lot. So why aren't we willing to put them out there? You know, one thing that happens in acquisitions meetings when publishers are acquiring a book is that they have comparative titles. They compare the two. And if that one book did very well, then they base, I guess, like their marketing spend on how many books they expect the other book to sell. But the problem is, because there's not many books out there by Black authors, the comparative title thing doesn't really work. There's not enough information for you to know. And the books that have been published a lot of the time, they don't get any marketing or publicity spend. Therefore, they don't become bestsellers. And then publishers act like, well, you know, people ain't, they're not buying these books. But publishers and booksellers have the power to make bestsellers if they want to. They can acquire a book that they think, okay, we're not sure how this is going to sell, so let's put as much force as we can behind it. You know, go to the booksellers, talk to the booksellers, maybe put it in a window, make sure it's on a table, and the book will sell.
Yeah.
The book will become a bestseller.
So it seems like from what you're saying, there's a message that needs to reach Black creatives and also reach publishers. It needs to reach creatives that they can be published, that their stories are worth being told. And then the message that needs to reach publishers is that this is, again, a message that can be beloved, can be embraced by people, and can be profitable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was your process of getting this book published? You know, Murky Books is one of the most exciting collections of new voices. How did that all sort of come to be?
Well, I got really lucky with that one, actually, because working at Penguin, I knew the editor of Murky Books. We were friends, and I was telling him about some upcoming projects I had. I spoke to him about a podcast I was going to do with my little brother, and he just became very excited by this and said, oh, this would be an amazing book. So he said, go and meet Stormzy's manager and talk to her about the book. So before I met Stormzy's manager, I sent her a few passages from That Reminds Me, just so that she could get a taste of my writing style. And then when I met up with her, she was just basically like, we want to publish the, you know, That Reminds Me, what you're writing here. She was like, I really like it. We would love to publish it. And I said, well, you know, the editor at Murky wants to publish this other nonfiction book with my brother. And she was like, okay, well, I'll sort it out. And then they came back and offered me a 2-book deal. The first one being That Reminds Me, the second one to be published at a later date.
It's pretty amazing. I have a lot of excitement around that project, and I'd love to ask you about it in a minute. But just going back to something from our previous question, in terms of advice, because hopefully publishers will catch on. For example, all of the shortlisted possible winners for the Desmond Elliott Prize this year were Black, which was really exciting in terms of new stories being told. In terms of reaching Black creatives, you wrote in one interview that the best piece of writing advice you were ever given was, for goodness sake, just write in your own voice, Derek. Is that the same advice that you would give Black aspiring creatives today, people that might be listening to this podcast and figuring out how to break into the industry and make their mark? Or is there anything else that you would like to tell them being a success story, sort of?
Yeah, so that piece of advice that I got, just writing my own voice, you know, I always quote that, but you know, my friend was speaking specifically about nonfiction when she said that to me, you know, not trying to make yourself sound smart or anything like that. Just speak to the page and say what you have to say. So in terms of nonfiction, that I definitely would give that advice. In terms of nonfiction, it still applies. You have to speak in your own voice, but obviously you have to give voice to different types of people. So it's almost like, it's like a filter almost, like, you know, yeah, that you're writing from your authentic self and giving these voices authenticity in whatever way you need to do it. So yeah, that's definitely some advice I would give. I would also say, enjoy writing, enjoy what you're doing. You know, don't see it as like real hard work. Try and have fun. The first draft of whatever you're writing should be fun. You should be able to entertain yourself and try new things, try tricks, literary devices, and all kinds of things that you want to do. And then second draft, third draft, fourth draft is when you really start to iron things out and polish it. I think that a lot of people see writing as this really serious endeavor, you know, very professional thing. And for me, it's never really been like that. I just have fun. And I feel like that's what more people should do when writing.
And from the perspective of, you know, people who are fortunate to be in the industry already, in terms of reaching out to the youth and helping provide them with opportunities we perhaps wish we'd had, do you have any personal perspective on that? Is there any outreach that you recommend others doing?
Yeah, I think mentorship is very important right now. I feel like, you know, you meet a writer, you know, young or old, but, you know, new to the industry, and you feel like they need some help, mentor them.
Yeah.
You know, speak to them regularly, give them advice, send them resources.
Yeah.
Maybe help them shape their proposal or introduce them to some agents. Mentorship is really important at the moment. I think that's one thing that we definitely need. We need to share the information, share the knowledge.
And you just said, you know, provide them with resources as well, which I think is such an important point. I read a tweet or something like that yesterday, and I might start following your advice to stay off Twitter. But it said something like, you know, Black creatives are over-mentored and underfunded. And that's something that's sort of stuck with me, because there is absolutely the need for mentorship. But then you almost need the people with funding, the brands, the companies, the publishing houses, the production companies to come in and offer a way to realize it. And that's my next question, is what companies or brands can do to reach you know, people who are trying to make it and help nurture them into those roles of success?
Yes, good question. I guess it just goes back to what I was saying about funding particular organizations.
Yeah.
you know, paid internships.
Absolutely.
Things like that, even if it's just like a role for 6 months, obviously you're paid and all of that, but so that the person can get a kind of taste for the industry, whichever industry it is, be able to put some experience on their CV. You know, one thing that was really good for me when I was trying to get into publishing is that, you know, there was an independent publisher called Knights Of that had just launched. And I had a meeting with one of the founders, and I was just saying to him, you know, I'm really trying to get into publishing, but I've got no experience. He said, well, okay, why don't I just create an internship for you for 6 months, and then you can put that on your CV and that'll help. And that's what he did. You know, and that was an amazing opportunity for me. So things like that really, really help.
And that's, from what I read, that's sort of a bit of what you're doing kind of on a large scale, but also really close to home with your brother. And I'm hoping you'll tell us a little bit about that project that you hinted at, because it sounds very exciting to me.
I'm very much invested in the transformative power of literature. I think that reading can change lives. And it changed my life. And it's just something that's so enjoyable. And I feel like I'm doing a disservice if I don't try and share that with other people. Because I was quite, you know, when I was 24 and I first started reading, I was angry at teachers and people who never put me onto this before. Like, why didn't you tell me about about literature before and how good it was?
Yeah.
So that's something that, I tried to share with other people when I was doing the Mostly Lit podcast. But then I realized that, you know, I have a little brother. Why am I not doing this with him? You know, so I said to him, you know, he's not really interested in reading. I tried to get him to read To Kill a Mockingbird once and he started crying.
Oh.
So I said to him, look, I'll give you £50 per book. We'll read 12 books. And then afterwards, you tell me how it relates to your life and what you're doing while you're gallivanting on the streets. And then I will give you the, I guess, generally accepted interpretation of the book. And then we can meet somewhere in the middle and have a nice discussion about it. And he said, cool. And then that's, so it's called Teaching My Brother to Read. Hopefully that's going to be the product, that's going to be the book. But frustratingly now, my brother has started working part-time, so £50 isn't as enticing as it was before, so I've had to up it to 100.
What book is he on now? What number?
He's on number 3 now. He's reading Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blume.
It's a great book. You've got a few hundreds to go then, haven't you, now that it's up so early in the process. Is it true that Idris Elba's production company has bought the rights to that book?
They've optioned it, yeah. Yeah. So hopefully it'll be made. But, you know, I think about 99% of things that get optioned never get made anyway. But fingers crossed.
Well, regardless, it'll be a journey that I'm sure we'll all follow along on. I hope he doesn't cry anymore. but best of luck to him and to you. Finally, to win an award as prestigious as the Desmond Elliott Prize is a testament to what an absolutely fantastic and important piece of work That Reminds Me is. How did you feel when you got the call to say that you'd won?
I didn't really believe it, actually. I remember saying to my agent, do you just have a feeling that I've won, or are you actually telling me that I've won? And she just she just kept saying, Derek, you are the winner. So yeah, it was very surreal. It still is kind of surreal.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out in my head what this all means, what this means for my future as a writer and things like that. But it's a great honor. It's such a great prize to have won. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, it's an absolute honor for us to have hosted you in general, but also so soon after this. It's been a pleasure to host you on AKQA Insights. And most importantly, I urge everyone listening to get themselves a copy of That Reminds Me. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.